I honestly don't think I was able to do my work to a standard that I feel is great until very recently. The consistency comes from sort of trusting your instincts, but also knowing how to apply them. And that really just comes from being open and doing therapy and, you know, opening up. I would be scared to listen. I would not let it happen. I would try to fill it. I was trying to control things. Now I really try to be as present and to listen as much as possible because I love not knowing what's coming next.
If you could spend a moment with some remarkable people and discover what their life sounds like, what would you ask? Welcome to Are We On Air? An audio encounter. I'm Armand Nafei, and each episode will feature one conversation with an inspiring friend of mine who will share with us the soundtrack to their life. What up, beautiful people, and greetings from sunny Los Angeles, and welcome back to another glorious interview here at Are We On Air? This week's guest is none other than the legendary Zane Lowe. Many of you might know Zane as the Grammy-nominated producer slash radio host slash Apple Music's creative director, or formerly of BBC Radio 1, or as a successful touring DJ doing the global circuits. Zane and I met at the Apple headquarters in Los Angeles a good couple of months ago to chat about, well, you guessed it, music. We covered everything from how he managed to make his way all the way from New Zealand to the top of the American dream. Welcome to Apple. We've covered his roots in hip hop all the way to his legendary interviews with the who is who of the music universe. From Neil Young to Barbara Streisand to Kanye West, he's had them all. From breaking the Arctic Monkeys and the Killers in the early 2000s, all the way to sharing Adele for the very first time. But we also covered our shared desire and quest for the holy grail of interviews, Sade. What a fun and insightful conversation this was. And here a big thanks to the team at Apple for hosting us and giving us a lovely tour of the HQ. Pretty impressive. Now, let's get the party started, and I'll speak to you soon.
Welcome to Are We On Air, Zane.
Thanks. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a brief moment. We touched.
We had a human experience.
We had a human experience at a bar at the Chateau a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And now I'm here in your home at Apple Studio, Apple
Music.
Yeah,
I mean, back again. It's like everyone, it was a few years of not being here and then coming back in, and it feels different to when I used to come in. I think everything was just happening one day after the next. And you stop and you come back in, you're like, what do I want the space to be? So that's what I'm trying to figure out, is how I want to move forward and you know, enjoy being in this space and kind of being a part of the excitement of music from inside Apple, you know?
I mean, it's super exciting. I mean, first time that I'm here, and I'm just walking through this building and just seeing how light and airy it is. I think it's very, very inspiring, I guess, as an office space.
That also inspires the way we approach the radio studios too, you know, for the most part. I never really understood. I know it's acoustic treatment and everything else, but.
Oh, is it?
Well, a lot of times when you go into rooms that don't have any natural light, it's in order to try to create the best possible audio experience and sound experience. I'm willing to give up a little bit of that. You know, I love the idea of Inside Out. I never really enjoyed going into radio studios that felt underground. I spent years in one in the UK, Radio 1, and I much prefer to be able to see what's going on, you know, just get a sense of life.
Yeah. I hear. Yeah. It's like the one that Brad Pitt just did in South of France. It's just basically this beautiful,
kind of
iconic studio that they kind of renovated. And it's all about that. There's like huge windows so you can look into the French countryside.
I think there's something to be said about that. I mean, I know that one of my sort of dreams, and I don't think I've ever even really expressed this before, but I would love to contribute in that way. I would love to have a space somewhere that's unexpected, that really accentuates the beauty and the, you know, what's beautiful and amazing about that environment in a way that is kind of inspiring from a creative point of view. You know, me and my friend have talked about somewhere like San Ynez or somewhere that just is off the beaten path, but when you go there, you feel so inspired and just to see if there's a way that you can contribute to that environment from a creative experience, you know, build a place somewhere that people want to go.
Yeah.
Not have to go, but you want to go.
Want to go, yeah. I think Sade is now the first artist to record in that studio.
Well, isn't that absolutely flawless?
And she recorded back in the day at the original studio. So how great is that?
Do you know her?
I wish.
Me too. Same here. Hey,
I'm sure you've been trying as well.
I actually haven't ever had the courage to even begin that journey, but it crossed my mind the other day that perhaps I should try. So maybe this is the official beginning of my attempt to try to gravitate.
Well, if that works here, give us some of the crumbs.
Back and forth.
Yeah.
Same.
I didn't get a no. That's, for me, was already I didn't get a no yet from her people.
Wow.
So that is a good sign.
That's a great
sign.
So
then I heard she's recording. I was like, oh, that's why I didn't get a no.
The race is on. And
she's the greatest.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't it like when Jay-Z and Beyonce were like kneeing on stage when she came on stage? That was like some show or something?
I don't know that particular situation, but I know there are a few artists who walk the earth as revered by such a cross-section of creative people. And I think it's really, it's hard to define why she is so timeless. It's just the most tasteful, authentic, soulful music, you know? I think that you can hear music that has been created with space in mind. But what is this kind of incredible element of Sade's music is that when you listen to it, it creates space in the listener. It's like it has this ability to almost separate the compression that goes on in everyday life and just creates space.
That's a nice
It's kind of really interesting to me. When I put her music on, unnecessary things fall away. It's pretty amazing.
I mean, that's why it's so timeless. Everybody likes, I don't know anybody who doesn't like Sade. It's like an easy, in a way, easy listening, consciously and subconsciously.
You know, it is, it's the finest plate with the freshest handmade pasta, with freshly discovered truffle, with the world's best evol served with a lovely fork. It's like three ingredients on a perfect plate.
And by a beautiful chef.
By someone who knows what to do with them.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's Michelin star shit, dude.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's a nice way of describing it.
Yeah.
It's funny, like, before we get into the concept of Avianair, but one of, Chef Eddie at Sunset Beach in the Hamptons, one of the hotels that I worked for many years, the best way he would describe the music to be played on a Saturday instead of on Friday to like the DJs.
Yeah.
It's like, just give them burgers and fries. Just give them burgers and fries. I'm like, that is such a good description.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, we do Balearic Sundays and then Jose Padilla come out. It's like really like we're going for the good. And Saturday is just give them burgers and fries.
And the thing is, you can still make the most delicious burgers and fries of all time, but you know exactly what they mean by that, right? It's like, it's something that everybody wants one day a week.
Exactly. Now, going to you and this concept of Avianair, let's start with your earliest significant musical memory that shaped you as an artist. And basically just pick a track, an album that
I mean, as long as I can remember, music was in the house. You know, my father was a founding member of a small group of people that called themselves pirates because they literally were pirates. They were in international waters broadcasting on a pirate radio station. And they really forced the government to give a commercial license over for the first time. Everything else was sitting ultimately in government-controlled broadcasting. So it was a rock and roll station. So there was music in the house. So there's a lot of swirling memories that when you ask a question like that. But I think the one that ultimately I could really trace back to being probably the earliest, most defining was, I remember sitting in the living room in what was my parents' house, had recently become my mother's house, trying to figure out how to navigate this kind of very acrimonious, stressful, emotional environment that had been caused by my parents' divorce and separation and being of a very young age. Searching for music and finding this album, which was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, which was Damn the Torpedoes. That album was a very defining record for me because, for some reason, I think because of the way he looked on the cover was like shocking pink. And then he was, as we know, the striking, super slender, very unusual looking guy that just jumped off the cover. And then the back, it was just all these grainy shots of the band, and it looked like a band, and the band sounded live, and he just sang like nobody else. Like, it was like, it wasn't conventional. It was really punk in a way for me. It just captured my imagination, and it became this kind of, it also became a very bonding experience for me and my mum, because it was an album she loved, and she listened to it a lot through those early days. And so, and I've mentioned this before, but I will never not, it really started me on this lifelong journey, conscious and subconscious, of trying to get to Jimmy Iovine, trying to get to him. Couldn't have been further away when I turned that record over and saw his name as a producer. And it took a good sort of 30 years to get there. It's so funny, when I finally had the courage to tell him that over dinner one night, he was like, great, man. I'm going to have the...
I have the burgers and fries.
I'm going to have the burgers and fries, exactly. But he's mentioned it since, so I know it resonated. So, it is what it is, man. I mean, that was a really important record. I mean, that was the earliest, but probably the most impactful, by the way, was really when I discovered like that the early rap records, when I realized that there was a genre of music that no one I knew had heard of. My brother didn't like it. He'd introduced me to everything up to that point. Rap, when it arrived on the scene very early, Just Ice.
Going way, way back to the early days of 75 and the Black Spades. Chilling with my homeboy, Muscle Man Ron, and the Boogie Down Bros, PKA P-Law. It was a privilege for people to see Bad Bottle, Bad Bottle, Bad Bottle 23 on a Friday night. The boys would come running to hear Big Beast. That was shocking and stunning in the hills.
Spoonie G.
I'm the Godfather. I'm the Godfather. I'm the Godfather of rap. Let's get this straight, there's no contest. So now you people know and don't have to guess. I'm not the king of rap, not lord, not prince. I was a young kid rapping, I've been rocking ever since.
You know, Grandmaster Flash, obviously.
It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
Glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat.
Then into sort of Eric Ben Rakim, very early Def Jam profile records. A lot of these very early labels that were leaning in, that was major for me, because being in Auckland and being immediately drawn to this music, I don't know why. I didn't really understand it. I didn't understand where it came from. That's been a life's journey. But it moved.
You started as a hip hop DJ, right?
Like, yeah, for sure. Look, I mean, as soon as hip hop entered into my life, that was it.
Yeah.
For a long time. And I was obsessed, and I lost friends over it. And, it was like, it was a thing. Like, people didn't understand. And back then, you got to remember, it was considered a fad. And it was just, it was the most misunderstood, needed to be understood genre of music ever.
Yeah, totally.
No one understood it. And yet it was dying to be heard and dying to be acknowledged and understood, because it was the realest. It was the most truth-talking genre ever. You know, who was it that said it's the CNN? Chuck D, I think, said it's the CNN of the streets. And so it hadn't landed in that yet. And so... I didn't recognize
that. The CNN of the streets.
Yeah, and I didn't recognize that. I was too young to truly understand that. Like I said, it's taken a lifetime of opening myself up to the music and what it means to better understand it, even I'll never truly understand it. But it moved me immediately. It excited me immediately. And then everything from there has really been informed by that.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. What track should we play?
I mean, let's go back to Tom Petty, because that's where it began. Okay. I think we should play Here Comes My Girl. I don't know, man. It's like this. You've been in love. You know what it feels like. Something that's not often talked about when you're in love with someone is pride. You talk about being obsessed, you talk about attraction. You don't often talk about feeling proud of somebody being in your life.
You know, sometimes I don't know why, but this old town just seems so hopeless. I ain't really sure, but it seems I remember the good times with just a little bit more in focus. But when she puts her arms around, stop, ask myself why I've done it. It just seems so useless to have to work so hard and nothing ever really seemed to come from it.
You don't often talk about the way they make you feel better about yourself, because how could I ever have gotten someone this special and spectacular to see something in me? Makes me proud to be in the same room as this person, you know? That's what the song really sums up. And that's how I feel about my wife.
Oh, wow. I've never heard that word proud or being like pride with love. Like, it's such an interesting way to look at looking at that.
Well, you know, when you walk in the room with somebody and you know that they just make you better in every way, makes you proud that they see in you something to share. And this song is really about that. It's like, when I look at my girl, man, like, ain't nothing I can do about it. Hey,
you know, have you ever sung that song to her?
Nah, she's heard it though many times.
Have you ever met Tom Petty? You interviewed him?
So there's a few that passed away too soon. Tom was one. I feel I was close, you know.
Oh.
I mean, I was 1 degree of separation with Jimmy away from If the Time Was Right. Prince was another. Kurt was another, you know.
When did you start interviewing him?
Young, but you know, when Nirvana came to New Zealand, it was at the height of Nevermind. And I was doing some interview stuff, but I was just getting started.
Yeah.
And they were not talking. I mean, they were already in the era of no. They were just hanging on, you know, trying to get through it. And so no one was coming to Auckland and like taking press requests. Sam, you'd have had the worst job ever trying to run press in New Zealand in 1992. So yeah, I mean, I never got to talk to Kurt. I never got to talk to Prince. And, you know, one of the things that really did when these tragedies started to happen and the sadness kicked in and the loss of these great artists was that made me realize, like, I've always loved and been grateful for the fact that I've been drawn to new music and new artists, but if the opportunity arises, then, you know, I must find time to speak to the people who ultimately inspired me, you know? And so as I've gone through life, and especially in the last 3 or 4 years, being able to talk to Bruce Springsteen and Neil Young and, you know, Annie Lennox and Barbara Streisand, and it's been awesome, man. And it's been really amazing for me just to kind of learn from the greats, because it was an area I wasn't really moving in. It was always like, are you new? I'll talk to you, you know.
Yeah.
It's nice to be able to.
Is it different? Like, there's a difference coming from FM, basically BBC to Apple, that you have now access, or is it standing, or is it actually through Apple?
It's a good question. I think it's a little bit of, maybe it's a bit of everything. It's hard to know whether my position has changed their perspective. Probably. I mean, I'm older. I've been around longer.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd hope that it would start to reach those kind of rooms. And in conversation, people might say, what about this person? But I think also coming to Apple and having multiple reasons to have a conversation rather than just at radio, you know, I was doing the new music show.
It was all promo.
Yeah, yeah. We would have to find reasons to talk to icons. Like, we would create a masterpieces series, or we would do like a legends series, and it'd be like, all right, cool, let's put, you know, now we can talk to, you know, someone of that stature, because for that week, that's what we're focused on. But every other day, if I wasn't sort of trying to draw attention to whoever was new and exciting in that moment, I wasn't doing my job. So it definitely has broadened out since I've come to Apple. And man, I mean, it's been such a welcome shift in direction for me.
I can only imagine. Yeah. I mean, I have, of course, the freedom with this little podcast to kind of pick and choose who I really want. But I'm also, and it's funny because now PR agencies are pitching me people who are in promo mode. I'm like, I might be interested in the artist, but not when they're in promo mode. I don't care about the new movie. I want to talk about the person.
That's
you know?
Really, that's good to hear, man, because it's really important. I actually really believe in distinguishing a format away from the requirements of promotion.
I mean, look at the late night TV. It's like copy, 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 copy. It's the
right.
same thing.
Right.
And everyone plays along. I right. mean, the guest and the interviewing. It's
and
just
I dig
business.
That because if I want burgers and fries, I'm going to go and gorge on burgers and fries. But no, it doesn't fit what you do.
Yeah.
And I think in a weird way, what I've tried to do is to build, hopefully, some kind of meaningful bridge between the two. Where you have something that you want to ultimately amplify, but I want to have a conversation over here. So if we can agree to cross the bridge willingly over the course of the next hour, we're going to end up somewhere that we're really happy with.
Hey, whatever you need to plug, you let me know. What's up? What's new at Apple Music?
Damn. You're now just reminding me I have nothing to plug. What am I doing with my life?
But going back to the music, and I know it's very difficult. Actually, before we go there, I have a little Prince anecdote.
Yeah.
I only saw him once. I never met him, but yeah. I saw him once at a private gig. But at auction, I bought two unreleased tapes of his.
Wow.
One is a band he produced in 1990.
Yeah.
And then one is from his ex-wife. He recorded Happy Birthday for her.
Marta?
Marta, yeah.
Marta, yeah.
Yeah. And she sold a couple of these personal items, and I
wow.
it was a bidding war. But I was like, I gotta have it. I didn't know what I was buying because wow. you can't listen
and
to it.
He's
before.
Singing Happy Birthday.
And he created like a minute and a half Happy Birthday without mentioning her name. I was like, we gotta put this on the record. Like, five. I mean, who wouldn't want to have a Happy Birthday song with my friends? I know. I gotta
that
play
is
it to you.
Wild.
I know.
Have you digitized it?
Not yet.
Oh, it's maybe like, you shouldn't.
I'm scared. I will. But I'm.
You gotta back it up somehow.
Yeah, for sure. But I'm also scared to. Do it like in a public place because then they have the file.
I wouldn't.
No.
I don't mean to be.
It has to be somewhere private.
I know that fans of you who are listening to this are like, why would you keep it from everybody? And maybe.
But it's such an intimate and beautiful way. Like, that's the other thing. I don't have to.
In a way, it's like it really raises into question what is too close. Like, how vicarious can we go? You have something that was meant for one person. Now she's decided to sell it for yeah. one reason or another. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't stay in the spirit of why it was created.
Exactly.
Right? And maybe if you just hold it on and you only share it to people on their birthday who really matter to you, that is in keeping of the spirit.
Exactly. That's where my head is at.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Good for you, dude. I never met him either. I would have if the album I would produced and written on had won album of the year at the Grammys, but it didn't. But he presented it to Beck in the end. I would have been on stage with him. But I saw one of, if not his last actual show. It was in January, I think, of 2015 at Coco in Camden in London. And it was, man, he started with Purple Rain.
Oh, wow.
Started.
Damn.
So if you can imagine at the
just
end
to
of
get out of the way, guys. Okay, here you got it.
Well, you know, go. Like that has the greatest encore moment of all time, right? At the end when he's doing the and everyone's doing the arms in the air. Down, 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 down. I mean, that should end every show for the rest of time. And he started with that. So it was a really strange experience being 6 minutes into the show and wondering, like, why do I feel like it's the end? Because he sort of started with the song you would normally feel it would be saved. And from there, it was the most mind-blowing show. But he's actually on my list. to talk about today, but maybe we'll get to him later, depending on where you go.
Coming. Well, it's very difficult, but how would you describe yourself? Who are you in three songs?
Wow. Yeah, I love this question. And I was kind to myself. I'm acknowledging that everything is ever changing and you can't stick to this, you know.
That's what I tell the guests.
It's really just the first of three songs that I felt sum me up today.
Mm-hmm.
Cause otherwise, you know, you don't want to live rent free in my head for too long. So, so I picked three songs that sort of sum up different parts of, I think, how I sort of move forward. One is this kind of idea of traveling and sort of looking for adventure. And, you know, I've got some miles under my feet. You know, I started in Auckland and ended up traveling across America and then went to London and now London, California. And, you know, so we've done some big jumps and seen some world and seen some life. And there's a song by Neil Young, who's a very important artist in my life, called Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere.
I think I'd like to go. There's a woman that I'd like to get to know, living there. Everybody seems to wonder what it's like down here. I gotta get away from this day to day running around. Everybody knows this is nowhere. Everybody knows.
And I think for anybody who decides to seek adventure, they realize after time that there's really only one sacrificial experience that kind of comes with that beyond the unknown experiences that you come, the challenge and the triumph. And that is that you're ultimately leaving behind the people that know you and love you the most. And it's a big move to let the people you love the most go. And as I've become a parent and realize that these days are coming for us and our children are going to go and immerse themselves 100% into their own identity and forge forward and build the lives that they can be proud of, that I'm also going to be in my mother's footsteps and in my mother's shoes and my father's shoes. And so this song means a lot to me because it really very, as all things with Neil Young, finds a way to cut straight to the subject and straight to the emotional resonance of the song without overcomplicating things. Neil is very good at just saying something that on paper would seem straight and honest, but somehow it presses buttons that are complex and hard to find. And, you know, I think I like to go back home and take it easy is the opening line. You know, there's a woman that I'd like to get to know living there. Everybody seems to wonder what it's like around here. And this place that you found and you've called home with the big city, this idea. But I got to get away from this day-to-day running around because everybody knows this is nowhere. And it draws into focus purpose. Why am I doing this? What is my purpose?
And it's your personal domestic bliss, right?
Yeah, like I'm running around, but where am I headed? You know, if you want to get really kind of macro on it, it's the old person fishing at the end of the pier. It's like, where does this lead ultimately? And shouldn't I just acknowledge that this is where it will end up? And can I do what I want to do from there and find some balance between ambition and peace? And I just think that it's good to just have that on your life's playlist at all times, because it just keeps you, it just reminds you, what is my ultimate purpose here? It's, you step out of the thrash, you listen to that song, you know, and it just grooves along and says something really deep without trying to be deep.
Uh-huh.
And it just sits with you. And I've referred to it many times in my life, listened to it many times in my life. And it keeps me grounded.
I have a feeling you're going to listen to it today.
It's just a great song.
Everybody seems to wonder what it's like down here. I gotta get away from this day to day running around. Everybody knows this is nowhere. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Oh.
I chose a song by Souls of Mischief, who are like a very sort of credible, influential Bay Area rap collective, part of the Hieroglyphics group of artists.
Hieroglyphics. I haven't heard that name in a long time. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big Hieroglyphics fan. I mean, you'll see me in Hiro merch all the time. Still. And there's a song called 93 to Infinity. Till Infinity, I should say. 93 Till Infinity. Mm. The reason why I chose this is not because the lyrical subject matter or anything like that is as specific as the Neil Young record, but the feeling, it came out when I was 20. The video was shot outside and all of this beautiful nature of the Bay Area reminded me of where I lived at the time in Auckland. It showed me that rap music could embrace the elements in a different way. There's a really beautiful, positive, youthful energy to the song. I love that it time stamped because it's often something that is considered to be, you have to be careful of that in rap music because you can date yourself. But I love it had the confidence to say we've made a copyright rap record. You will go back and remember this was made in 1992-93 and it's fine because it's still going to sound amazing, and it does.
It captured the zeitgeist in such a beautiful way that even today it still resonates with the youth, you know?
Those opening chords from the Billy Cobham from Heathers, you know, which is one of the great, great, super, super beautiful, meditative, you know, slow-building dynamic jazz records ever from the Crosswinds album. And, you know, everything about it to me, it improved my concept of what is tasteful.
In what way?
When you have moments like that, they get added to this kind of unconscious equation of what drives your taste, what's important to you. You would feel that way when you touch a piece of fabric and go, it reminds me of when I felt something like this for the first time. It changed the way I'm going to dress for the rest of my life, you know? When you taste, can tell. When you that's why I say that, because you clearly like the feeling of good fabric, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, when you eat something delicious, well, my palate just changed and I can't eat
broken fries anymore.
Right? Unless I consciously want to have that experience.
Yeah.
As we grow as human beings, you know, we absorb more things. You can't help but absorb the ones that truly resonate with you, and it changes how you feel about things. It's a feeling. 93 till Infinity gives me a feeling. And I could be making music, I'm still searching for that feeling. Like sometimes I listen to something, I'm like, it has that feeling, I'm all in. So it's a part of my DNA now, just as one of the most tasteful records of my life. And I, you know, this is an opportunity for me to recognize that. So Souls of Mischief, 93 to Infinity.
Yo, what's up? This is Tajay of the Mighty Souls of Mischief crew. I'm chilling with my man Festo, my man A-Plus, and my man Oak. You know, he's dope. And right now, you know, we're just maxing in the studio. We're hailing from East Oakland, California, and sometimes it gets a little hectic out there. But right now, you know, we gonna up you on how we just chill.
Dial the 7 digits, call up Bridget, her man's a midget. Plus she got fridge, yo, I can dig it. Here's a 40 swigging, you know it's frigid. I got him chilling in the cooler, break out the ruler. Damn, that's the fattest dog I ever seen. The weather's heating, Cali getting weed, it makes her feel like Maui. Now we feel the good vibrations. So many females, so much inspiration.
And the third record, I'm going to choose, there's a few going around in my head. I'm going to choose Smashing Pumpkins, Tonight Tonight. Because I've suffered from anxiety a lot in my life, and I've definitely spent a lot of time worrying over things I have no control over, locked in a process or stuck in a process that's been really hard to break. And as I've sort of committed to solutions and therapy and doing the work, I've really enjoyed watching kind of the world open up and my perspective soften, my patience for things, for myself mainly, just everything. I try to find a joy in things that I felt was unattainable for quite a lot of my life. And so I wanted to choose a song that makes me feel that sense of just absolute unbridled optimism and positivity, and that almost the opening your eyes for the first time. And when I think about what song sounds like opening your eyes for the first time in a long time, it's Tonight Tonight.
Wow.
You know, when it opens in the strings and the guitar and it's just driving, I think about like, wow, imagine absorbing the world for the first time again, you know, and seeing what it all feels like. We take everything as we move through in life in our stride, which I always think that phrase is interesting, because what you're really saying is you're sort of moving on, moving past things all the time. Tonight Tonight is really about stopping and absorbing what's right in front of us. It's about accepting that the elements and nature and the human experience and the feelings we feel and the ups and the downs and everything that makes life such a joy and a gift is pretty well documented in that song.
Wow. I had this same experience once with, it's a walking meditation, mm-hmm. where we walk through life oblivious in a way, right? Yeah. Everything is like normal. But the moment you actually stop,
yeah.
and really pay attention to what's around you, suddenly I'm like in the middle of a city and I see a tree and everything became so much more like 3D.
Yeah.
Like it's green and real. And you suddenly had this, like, you were covered in bliss. Like if you were content in that moment.
I really try to do that now as much as I can. Yeah. I can't say that I'm in some sort of meditative Zen-like experience, but I'm conscious of trying to do it. And by the way, that it's not always a blissful experience. Sometimes you feel a deep empathy or a deep sadness or a deep sense of unhappiness. It's being unafraid to feel that too, to feel that as well, and to feel emotions as they flow through you. I spent a long time trying to avoid them for fear of not being able to process. My obsessive compulsive disorder is such that I could shut down and really literally sit still and quite successfully avoid everything out of fear. And I've worked really hard with the love of my family and my friends and the work I've done as well, give myself some credit to try to come through the other side of that and open myself up to emotion and open myself up to feeling things. I'm feeling something now just talking to you, about it. And so, you know, this song is something that I understand more and more every time I listen to it, because I feel that it grows with my ability to absorb. It's special.
And it has that self-discovery and you opening up yourself to the world in a way and sitting still. Has that also influenced the way you have conversations?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I honestly don't think I was able to do my work to a standard that I feel is great until very recently. I feel like I'm having a great experience now. Up until then, I think my instinct was to do great things, but I hadn't done the work and I didn't have the diligence. And I didn't have the self-awareness or the ability to be able to combine all of that. So to put it into an athletics analogy, you know, on my day I could score some goals, but then the next day I might foul out.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And the consistency comes from sort of trusting your instincts, but also knowing how to apply them. And that really just comes from being open and doing therapy and just, like I said, being you know, opening up to emotion. And that's only happened very recently. I would be scared to listen in an interview situation. I'd be worried.
Because of the silence of them.
Yeah, because I didn't want to, scared's too strong a word, but I would not let it happen. I would try to fill it, or I would try to think of the question before the answer was even finished. I was trying to control things. And I think now I really try to be as present and to listen as much as possible, because I love not knowing what's coming next.
Hence, we just jumped in, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I agree. And it's my...
That's why I said at the beginning, just stop.
Yeah. I love that. And I think that's... Well, I mean, we just touched on that, but I think there's there, hopefully there is a shift, especially with all this like noise of conversations from talk shows to podcasts to radio, all that kind of hopefully away a little bit from this just chatter, this noise. I mean, everything is just feels like just noise and not actually taking the time and really like have a normal, authentic, organic conversation. It's like if you and I would be sitting in a pub, we would not have like a Q&A, right? We would have a conversation.
Well, look at all the great things that come from it.
Yeah.
Like I'll walk away and I'll have a little bit more understanding about who I am because I will have been encouraged to express myself and verbalize things that were sitting somewhere else. Although you, I will have learnt from you. I'll have this experience with you that will lead to other experiences you and I will share and other people will share together. And some people may listen to this and learn something. Some people may turn it off after 1 minute. Some people may listen to it all the way through.
Don't care about those people.
Haters gonna hate. But it's all about extending the experience into like a positive energy and just letting the wave continue to crash on shore and just continue to go forward like just a millimeter by a millimeter by a millimeter. And we try and get ahead of ourselves and try to make these really big grand statements or big changes. We've been changing and there's a time for that and we need to do that. And it's, when things get to out of control, then they need to be addressed en masse and in a big, major way. But every single day, just a tiniest self-awareness or just the smallest observation like you said about the tree or just having a conversation which goes beyond the banal and actually gets into something a little bit more real, it all adds up.
Absolutely.
It all adds up.
It's the patina that just adds on.
I'm not afraid of noise. I'm just looking for the stuff that's actually contributing some value, you know?
How important is silence to a conversation?
Yeah, I'm a fan. And I like I said, I never used to be. It's a great question, by the way. I never used to be available to it. And now, if it happens organically and it's worthwhile silence, I love it. Because I like to see and feel someone's thought process in action. And I like conversations that shift in dynamics. You know, my brain goes really fast. I'm pretty restless with my thoughts and where they go and how I communicate. And sometimes I can trip over my own words because my brain's going so fast, my mouth can't keep up. And that's not to say I'm smart. That's to say I'm probably not smart enough. So I overcompensate. But pace is really important. And I think silence is a gift. And I think if someone's willing to give you silence in conversation, it's worth something.
Absolutely.
There's real value in that.
Yeah. Actually, I just saw recently, last week, the Lex Friedman, Kanye conversation. And he's actually, I mean, that's ignore the noise for a second and whatever he says. But actually, he's really good in midst conversations, just go blank. And you can see him just thinking about his answer for a second, like 30 seconds.
The host or the subject?
Kanye.
Yeah.
I don't know. It does on purpose just to create, add more drama, or he actually goes into, before I say anything, let me think about this.
Yeah, he's given me the longest silence of any conversation I've ever had. I can't remember how long it was. I can't remember. We counted it, though. It was definitely over 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Of just absolute silence.
What do you do?
Oh, wait. I sat in it. I'd begun to accept silence by that point. So I sat in it.
I mean, what are you going to do?
I mean, it's, you know, someone wants to take their time.
Yeah.
Take your time. We're not on the clock. You know?
That's the beauty of not being live on air, right?
100%. And by the way, even if you're live on air, like I'm all for it live on air.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just the more normal and human we can be, even when we're on a microphone or whatever, then we remove this sort of facade of this character-driven exercise that we feel we have to give. Don't get me wrong. I love great characters and entertainment. I think people, I mean, Matthew Healy for me right now is stepping into each role differently and I love it. And I want him to be that chameleonic human being when he's in his band. You know, I'm searching for something that feels kind of real.
Let's leave it at that. I like that. What song would you choose for your time at the BBC? What song would you choose at your time at Apple?
Oof, good question. At the BBC, probably Arctic Monkeys.
Oh, interesting.
I bet you look good on the dance floor.
I wish you'd stop ignoring me because it's sending me to despair. Without sound, yeah, you're calling me and I don't think it's very fair that your shoulders are frozen. I bet that you look good on the dance floor. I don't know if you're looking for romance or I don't.
Or The Killers, Mr. Brightside. These are two songs that I was lucky enough to kind of play significantly for the first time. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Monkees probably got a demo. They would have got demos played on local radio, so respect to all outlets that support music early on. But having that microphone and that time slot on Radio 1 was impactful. You know, you're stepping into a big show. It's the evening session slot, and pre-internet, pre-streaming, or definitely pre-streaming, the internet was around, but pre-streaming, you know, that was the appointment to listen if you're a new music fan, and it was the spot you wanted to get on if you're an aspiring artist. And so, you know, when I got that gig, I was wonderfully naive. I knew the importance of the slot, but I didn't realize what was expected and what was going to happen. And as soon as I got the gig, I suddenly thought, well, where am I going to find these artists? I mean, John Peel broke The Smiths and The White Stripes, and Steve Lamacq and Joe Wiley broke Oasis and all these big bands. You know, everyone's got this laundry list of people they can say, oh, you know, started on this show with this host. Like, what am I going to, what if I come up empty? Like, what if I don't break anything? You know, like, it's kind of part of the gig. And so, you know, early doors, getting The Killers' Brightside off to the races through the show was not only really important for my confidence as a radio DJ within that time slot and that particular era, the new era at that time, but it also led me into a world where the music really presented itself for a few years. It was like between The Killers and Arctic Monkeys and...
You're the indie era.
Yeah, indie rock and roll was on fire. Block
I used
Party
to live in London back then, so I was like in the midst of it.
You know the deal? Yeah. And then Adele, you know, me playing Hometown Glory for the first time. That's probably actually your answer. Your answer is probably Adele Hometown Glory on Jamie T's independent label
Jamie
Pacemaker.
Yeah.
One song only came out in Pacemaker. And
was that 2000?
Couldn't even tell you, but I mean, that was a big moment. And I think, and what's mad about that one is that was a big, like, we played Rolling in the Deep for the first time when it came, so she came back, and it was a whole different world then, and everyone was waiting, and it was a huge smash. You knew it was going in one way for Adele. She was going to become the biggest artist on the planet in that time. We knew when we played Hometown Glory that night, we knew, just like we knew with Arctic Monkeys, we'll be talking about this record for years.
Wow.
Like, we will always be proud of being lucky enough to share this record on the radio for the first time, which really matters to the artist, it really matters to the fans, it really mattered to us, it really matters to the industry. Everyone who's invested in music from a beautiful, holistic standpoint, even before you get into numbers and dollars and cents and math, it matters when you hear that getting shared. It's a huge moment. And so to be able to do that with records like that was huge. So I had a really good run at Radio 1 with that.
Run my hometown, making Maurice afraid. Run my hometown, ooh, the people I've made are the wonders of my world, are the wonders of my.
How many demos did you have to go through to get to someone like Adele, for instance? And what were, like, how did you make that decision from a curatorial?
Yeah, I mean, Adele was not a demo process, trust me. I mean, by that point, everybody knew that she was special. And that record, Jonathan was already on board and managing her, and people knew. And so we didn't know it was going to be what it became because it was one song. That's all we had was one song, but we knew it was special.
Mm-hmm.
Arctic Monkeys was a demo. Arctic Monkeys was handed to us by a guy called Stuart, who was a radio plugger, someone whose job it was to present music to radio stations and ultimately try to position it on shows. Very important job.
What an interesting job.
You have to have great taste.
Yeah.
And he has, I'm sure, still great taste. And he brought the demo to my radio producer and said, I've just got this, check this out. I think this is special. He played it to me. we had a slot on our radio show called The Hottest Record in the World, which was like the one song that was like stood out on every show, the song of the day. And it was normally reserved for big artists coming through with big songs. By that point, it had become established, and labels and managers and artists would sort of pitch their songs to be this thing. And it was great. It's like when you have something like that, it's like it's the dream because people want you to play their songs. We made that the hottest record the day we heard the demo. A demo from a band from Sheffield that we knew nothing about. That's how good it was. We were like, this is absolutely crazy. Like, what is this? Like, this is so dialed in, like, and then that's cool. You take a shot on those things all the time. What happened next was what was sort of unheard of, which was that within 2 or 3 months, they were the biggest band in the UK. That at the time was unheard of. And that's why everybody got so swept up in this idea of it being an internet thing. Because no one could understand how it happened so quickly. It had to be the internet.
It was MySpace,
right? But it wasn't the internet.
Right?
It wasn't the internet. It wasn't MySpace. I mean, the fans did it on the internet.
Yeah.
But the band just handed out demos in Sheffield. The quality of the music is what did it. And so, yeah, I mean, the Arctics was a demo for real. And that was a great moment. And sorry, Alex, Matt, Jamie, and Nick, and Andy, I'm still telling that story. While they're making the album of the year, which couldn't sound more different. I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor.
Yeah.
That's a great album, The Car. Wow. Apple, you know, Apple has got to be, you know, any one of the first few weeks of songs. Halsey, New Americana, you know, Khalid, Location. There was, when we arrived at Apple, we were hoping that all the big artists that we'd had a great relationship, built a great relationship with during my time at the BBC, and that, you know, Jimmy knew and everything else would all line up to give us these big songs and give us all these exclusives, quote unquote. And they didn't, because they were like, you know, we have these existing relationships with established media and we can't just start giving you all this stuff. Like, we've got to keep this relationship sweet and you're new. And yeah, we love all of you and you're great. And we're sure it's going to be successful. But right now, you have no track record. You've got this new thing at Apple. Like, what do you want us to do? Like, just like sacrifice this relationship with the BBC or with iHeart or with Sirius or and give you this thing? Like, what do you think it's going to do to our business? Like, you've got to prove it. And we underestimated that. But the beauty of that was that in not getting those callbacks, what was really great was that we ended up still leaning into those kind of song of the day features, really amplifying the right songs, the right artists. But we decided to focus on the artists that were coming out right then and there. And that was the whole philosophy of Beats One that has ultimately kind of informed Apple Music One. And I think is a big part of what makes Apple Music unique is that we don't create a hierarchy the way they used to be based on what deal you signed and how successful you are. We put Halsey, New Americana, right next to the biggest artists in the world at that time. We made her my world record in the first week. And of course, that song broke her wide open and now she's this huge superstar. We learned that actually the way that people are absorbing and listening to music now, you can reach your audience so fast, there's little to no risk if you actually believe in it and the artist is ambitious and is going to see it through. Like, it used to be like, oh gosh, you used to say how many demos? Like, yeah, it felt so strange. Like, playing new music, you'd almost have to create categories within like sections of your show to do that.
Well, the technology obviously plays a big role in that, because it used to be, you're an indie boy, you're an indie boy.
Totally.
Now it's there are no genres. It's playlist driven.
Like, if I look at my TikTok feed, which is something I'm obviously pretty obsessed with right now,
and I
look at what's moving my TikTok feed, you know, I'm putting Fred Again next to Arctic Monkeys, next to the 1975, next to Billie Eilish. And right at the top here is this kid, Rio Vaz, who I put a post up, and that's doing great numbers. You know, it's like, you just don't have to look at it in terms of hierarchy anymore. And that first week of Beats One taught me that, like, the list of artists that we really leaned into and said, these are the biggest records and the biggest artists right now, most of them went on to become that. And that was the valuable lesson. Like, wow, it's changed. It may only take a year. And nowadays, it may only take a week. Or a day.
Yeah, I was about to say, like,
or a day.
Yeah. Amazing. So, which track shall we
play? Halsey, New Americana.
There you go.
There it is.
I
I mean, I'll tell you a quick story about that, man. I you know, Jimmy and everybody who invested so much and had so much faith in us to build Beats One in a short period of time, I was so thrilled with the launch. And then I was like, great, I get to dine out on this for a little while. Within a couple of days, I was in Jimmy's office and he's like, you haven't broken a record. It's all good that you built this radio station, but if you don't break a song, then what are we doing? And then within 2 days, wow, we played New Americana, and it had broken wide open. And to Horsey's credit and the label's credit, they'd given us, they'd said this started on Beats One. They did this. They're the ones who believed in this. And Jimmy was like, all right, you got away with that. So really, there's an interview online where Horsey goes, I feel like kind of owe something to you. And I said, oh, no. I owe everything to you. Because without this song, I may not have made the week. So that's the truth.
Oh, my God, the pressure.
We were feeling it.
Did the anxiety flare up?
100%. Because how do you manufacture a hit record if it doesn't exist? So that was a beautiful moment where someone somewhere was shining down upon us at that moment in time. Nicholas.
Wow. Wow. Thank God that would have crumbled.
No.
But going back to your DJ career.
Yeah.
You remember like one moment that playing live that just stuck with you? You're like, I will never forget that moment.
Yeah, it was probably playing my first Coachella. I think it was about 2008, right at the dawn of EDM. You could feel it. Something had shifted. I was put in the Sahara tent, which is like the size of a small city. And I was on at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a very unrealistic time slot for someone like me who I was like, why am I even in this tent, let alone at this time? Like I should be way down the bill somewhere much smaller. But I came on and built my audience in that room. And I played this very established, big, big sort of high tempo classic called Darude by Sandstorm, which is like, you cannot lose. And I drew on that song at this moment in time. And to this day, there's still footage of it online if you look for it on YouTube. I mean, it's like 8,000 to 10,000 people just all going one way. And it was like a real moment of like, oh, something's happening here. Like that was a moment where I was like, I will never forget this day because something is happening. And then sure enough, within a year, majority of all festivals were leaning in, and EDM was the most profitable, arguably the most profitable genre of music on the planet, and was for quite a while. So, you know, that was big. But then also, you know, getting to go and tour with, there was a really sweet spot for a few years when I would go and do these Australasian tours and these UK tours and sometimes American tours with like my heroes, like Chemical Brothers, mm-hmm, Prodigy, Skrillex, Deadmau5. The Weeknd, I got to go and I did a UK arena run with The Weeknd. It was a crazy, like just going and DJing and just getting to see these artists every night. And the Chemical Brothers one was very special because it was the first time I went home and really played an arena show in New Zealand supporting them. So yeah, I mean, it was just, I was in a sweet spot. You know, I'd figured out what was unique about how I played and what I played. And I was really like pushing my selection into new territory. I wasn't just leaning on classics. I was searching for new records. I really felt like I had learned what it took to truly DJ through my own taste and not just what I knew was going to work for a crowd. Like I was confident enough to take risks. I was willing to play deep, you know, stretch out the middle of the set and just take it down to build it back up.
Yeah.
Like, you don't do that when you first start. When you first start, you're just searching for reaction.
Yeah.
Your insecurity
you just want to be told
by the crowd you're good.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
And it takes, you know, you really got to know what to truly know about the art of DJing is to be able to sacrifice that sometimes for the sake of taking the audience on a different journey and knowing that it will work out in 20 minutes.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's when I was really kind of hitting my sweetest spot. And so I would say probably, you know, Eric Prydz, who I love, you know, that sweet spot between emotion and big room, maybe like an Align remix or, you know, I'll text you the specific song because you've got me in a good place. I want to make sure I choose right. But, you know, either that or High Contrast, if we ever get out of here, a beautiful drum and bass record, which is I would always end my sets. If I had a 2-hour set, I would always end with drum and bass because I love getting climbing tempo ladders. And so, yeah, that's a good one. We'll end with If We Ever Get Out of Here by High Contrast. It's such a beautiful closing song because it's got that really lovely piano. It's got the tempo, but it's emotional and it's like, when it finally drops, everybody goes crazy, but it's not in an aggressive way.
Yeah,
everyone's
kind
of dancing together. So yeah, we'll play some High Contrast. He's wicked, and yeah, that's a good one.
All right. Well, after a good 9 hours, you met your sweetheart, you were dating or you're breaking up. What's your go-to? Falling in love or heartbreak?
It's all about falling in love. I'm not in the breaking up business. Well, this one could go either way. This one could be breaking up or falling in love. But I went, did a karaoke. My wife wanted to do karaoke on her most recent birthday. And so there were libations and, you know, lots of alcohol was consumed. It was a great night. We all sang, everyone sang. We ended up doing Maps by Yeah Yeahs for each other. Which could be a breakup song. I mean, it's really almost unrequited, but you can spin it into a beautiful love song. And it's hard to hear that without getting emotional, you know. There's a moment in that song where Karen rises to the arrangement for the first time into the chorus, and it's like, it's hard not to fall over on that in that moment. So I love that song, and
we love Karen.
that's a memory that myself and my wife Cara will have and will laugh about many years to come, is cheek to cheek doing Maps by Yeah Yeahs. It's pretty funny. Quite a lot of wine in the system, but yeah, I love songs, and you know, Bon Iver, Jeff Buckley. I mean, I could make a long playlist of those kind of songs. I love heartbreak songs too.
Yeah.
I'm just not in the business of building a soundtrack for real life experience there.
Well, when you're falling in love and you're in the bedroom and you're feeling super sexy, what's the sexiest song?
Sexiest song. I find things like, you know, I mean, for me, probably the sexiest artist ever is Prince. And that's not to try to ever narrow his abilities into just sexy music. Like, Prince was also heart-wrenching, faith-driven, protest music. I mean, there wasn't anything he didn't do. But I Want to Be Your Lover, to me, is probably one of the sexiest songs ever written, because it's got that four on the floor beat, which to me is just the perfect tempo for making you dance and cry or laugh or smile. I love house music. I love the soulfulness of the house tempo. I love that you can go double time, double time, double time, or you can double time, double time. And you know, you can really lean in from a writing point of view. And I just think Prince just nailed that. So I think Prince, I Want to Be Your Lover, is like, to me, just like such a sexy record. And he's such an incredible example of someone who was able to make you feel that, but in a way that was like super tasteful and stylish, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
I've played that record out as a DJ many, many times, and you know, everybody
loves
is having a good time.
Everybody. Always. Always.
Certain tracks, doesn't matter if it's a birthday party, if it's like a rave, they just work. You know?
There's a great re-edit of that. I can't remember who did it. I wish I could, and I'll let you know. But there's a great re-edit of that, which is like the original, but it's kind of they create, he edits, or she or whoever edits in an introduction of the live performance of it. It's great for DJ tours. Me and Mark Ronson, when we used to do back-to-back DJ sets, we would always end our set with it. So it starts with this whole, like, you know, dun, 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 and the crowd screams immediately because they recognize the piano line. And so he's singing it, you know, and he'll be like, you know, don't want to pressure you, babe. And he'll go, sing it, y'all. And he does that thing. And everyone in the crowd sings it back. And every one of them is a female. It's like you might just hear a couple of guys in there, but it's just all women singing back to him. And it's like so perfect because every woman who's singing back is just note perfect in key. It's like he's like, if you're going to sing this back at me, you better nail it. So no one's out of key. It's the most perfect crowd response ever. Like everyone's just waiting to sing back at Prince, and when they do, they're like, don't fuck this up. It's so good.
So true.
And then the track kicks in real time, and it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful moment.
Oh man, shout out to Prince.
Well, I miss him.
Ah,
the best.
Well, Let's wrap up our little chat with the last question, shall we?
Yeah, man. Flew by the way.
I know.
Isn't the music brilliant? Isn't it magic?
I know. I know. I could talk for hours about music.
We will.
I guess.
Over time.
So, if your life would be a movie.
Oh, my God. This is so hard.
What someone play in the end credit?
Oh, I mean, this is one I really didn't give any thought to because I don't know if I'm even going to nail this. I mean, it's so hard. The only way I can really consider this question with any framework is to give it framework, right? Like I can't just open myself up to the world of music.
The Apple Music documentary about Zen.
It's never going to happen. But the only way I can get to an answer is to sort of trace my steps. And if I go back further enough, I'm going to end up back in New Zealand. So it has to be a New Zealand artist. It has to be a New Zealand song. It's where I was born. Without that origin, without that life that I spent there, I would not have traveled and, you know, continue to sort of gratefully and thankfully be in this life. And so it's got to be a New Zealand song. Then I think about, okay, who's the greatest songwriter in New Zealand history? It's Neil Finn. So is it Split Enz? Is it Crowded House? Is it Finn Brothers? What is it? It's Crowded House. If it's Crowded House, take your pick. And so I could go like Dust from a Distant Sun or Fall at Your Feet, but those are quite specific to relationships and to the world as a whole. Neil has this amazing ability to kind of immerse himself in nature and make it about a personal experience or a relationship. I'm going to go with something from Together Alone, from the album Together Alone. And I'm going to choose Private Universe, which I think is probably Neil's crowning moment in that era of Crowded House. And it's just a song that starts with the sound of percussion being played in the middle of a sort of natural environment of forest, effectively on the edges of a black sand beach called Karikari, which is where the album was recorded. And they would go out and they would record like drums and stuff surrounded by birds and by the nature. And so it starts there. You can hear the stream running through it. So it immediately reminds me of where I'm from and what those trips felt like and going to that beach. I know that beach. I know that stream. You know, I know that place. The music just subtly again settles into this groove, and lyrically I think he just absolutely captured what it is to try to extricate yourself from your own constructs of distractions and thrash and frequencies and all the stuff, and just try to find a place of ultimate calm. But all the way through that meditation is this kind of restless beat and this energy, and the whole thing to me is just stunning. And by the time it finishes, you sort of feel like you want to go round again. And so that to me kind of sums it up beautifully, is that as the credits roll and come to an end, maybe you might want to live this life again, you know, maybe you might want another go at it, because actually through all of the challenges and the sadness that can come and go, it's pretty epic.
Well, I'm not going to add anything, so... Zane, thank you very much for being on air with us. It was a real pleasure.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Don't do the promo.
We never.
Other people, I'll do the burgers and fries for you. Yeah. How about that?
I'll keep the oysters.
Keep the oysters and the bellinis. Yeah. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. We'll be right back.
Tuning in this week. If you want to listen to the full playlist, visit areweonair.com or our Spotify channel. You can also find us on Instagram and on YouTube at areweonair. And a big thank you to my wonderful team at Studio Noi. I'm Armand Nafei, and I'll speak to you soon.